From the Sky News Centre at 6, a convicted killer and paedophile has been found guilty of raping and murdering two teenage girls in 1977. Christine Eady and Helen Scott, who were both 17, were killed after a night out at the World's End pub in Edinburgh. The prosecution against 69-year-old Angus Sinclair is the first to be brought under Scotland's double jeopardy law. He's been jailed for life with a minimum 37 years. Helen's father, Moraine Scott, says her life was cut tragically short.
Her life was stolen from her. She was only just 17. She had ambitions in life. It stole a part of me and my wife. It stole a part of everybody.
Police are investigating abusive tweets sent to Olympic gold medalist Jessica Ennis-Hill. Yesterday, the heptathlete said she wanted to remove her name from one of Sheffield United's stands if convicted rapist Ched Evans re-signed for the club. John Bercow's criticised the Prime Minister for announcing anti-terror plans while in Australia. The Commons Speaker says MPs should have had the opportunity to question David Cameron over proposals to cancel suspected jihadis' passports and ban them from the UK for 2 years. Student Jasim Malik is a British Muslim and is concerned about how the measures would be applied.
Given the complexity of what's happening in Syria, how can you reasonably say that someone who, you know, comes back from the Middle East or has a Muslim-sounding name, is that, you know, valid for a suspicion? And, you know, taking away passports is a very serious issue. So we're already on a slippery slope.
Police examining allegations of a paedophile ring with links to Westminster have revealed they're investigating a potential killing. The operation had initially centred on claims of abuse dating back more than 30 years. Alex Salmond says Scotland will have a successful independence referendum in the future as Nicola Sturgeon officially takes over as leader of the SNP. Mr Salmond's successor also insists that if enough people want an independent country, there will be one. And Christoph Waltz has apparently signed up to star in the next Bond movie. The two-time Oscar winner is rumoured to be playing the villain opposite Daniel Craig's 007. And that's the latest. I'm Glenn Moore.
The King of Jerusalem founded an order of knights. Shortly after he was crowned, called the Knights Templar. Their first task was to explore the caverns and tunnels below the Temple Mount and find whatever relics of the past that they could find. They became the richest order in the world. They became the first international bankers. Their symbol is two knights riding on one horse. When they joined the order, they had to give up all their worldly possessions, goods, money, clothes, property, everything, to the order.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A Conspiracy of Silence, well, that was the name of the film that nobody showed you, even though it cost $500,000 to make, about US child abuse. We have an exclusive interview with the award-winning journalist, TV documentary producer Tim Tate, who lives here in the Southwest. In the early 1990s, he made an hour-long documentary called The Conspiracy of Silence for the Discovery Channel about a care home, child prostitution and drug running ring with collusion by the FBI at the very top of the Republican Party in Nebraska and in Washington in the United States. $500,000 on, and the documentary was legally watertight and on the TV schedules, but it was pulled by Discovery Channel. Although it's available online, it was never shown on TV either in the UK or the US. Tim tells me the story of how his documentary on these sexual abusers was made, then closed down, and how the victims ended up dead or doing decades in jail, while many of the perpetrators just carried on their political careers. Also, tasers, another death in Wales last week. So we ask, is this technology developed for use in slaughterhouses actually appropriate to be deployed on our streets? So anyway, we better start with that story since the CD has packed up. And I'm joined, I'm very happy to say, by Kevin Phillips, who's the chairman of Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Hi, Kevin, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, Tony. Good evening, Martin.
Now, first of all, let's start on the taser story I just mentioned there. I'm really shocked to see that in the United States, Amnesty International have pointed out that something like 500 people now in the US have died directly related to being hit by a taser. I know that when the police deploy tasers, they don't always use them. Something like about only 10% of the times where they're actually deployed do they actually then get fired. I mean, the most people will do exactly as they're told when they've got a taser pointed at them. But this is 50,000 volts. It can actually stop your heart from beating. Are these really just arming the police?
No, to be totally honest with you, Tony, I think it's probably one of the less lethal options that we've got. If you are dealing with a very violent situation and you can stun somebody with the taser, it quite often stops injuries occurring to both police officers and that person involved. You know, it is a way of restraining somebody.
Well, you say stun, but there's something like 10 deaths here in Britain and 500 in the US. This isn't stunning. This is killing people.
Yes, but I think you've got to look how many times the tasers are actually deployed throughout the time. If you look at Avon and Somerset, the figures for Avon and Somerset are worked out between March and March each year. So the 2013-14 figures, taser was actually deployed 245 times in that period. That's 5 times a week.
Now, does that mean actually fired or just deployed?
Just deployed. As soon as you draw that from the holster, that is a deployment and it has to be recorded.
Okay, and so how many times were they actually fired then? Something like, I'm going to guess, because the national figures are about 10%, between 20 and 30 times.
I would probably suggest you're probably about right on that. I haven't got the actual figure for that.
But that's more important, isn't it? I mean, you know, we should have the figures for that sort of thing. Because, you know, have you ever been shot by one of these things?
No, and I don't think I would ever want to. If I'm totally honest with you, and you've suggested the point there that once people have the taser pointed at them, they generally comply with what they are required to do. If I was, and the terminology is red dotted, if I had a red dot on my chest, I think I would know exactly what's coming next if I didn't comply.
Well, hopefully that wouldn't be taking place in Avon and Somerset, because I know police officers are told in their training that they should not be pointing the taser at the chest, that it should be being pointed at another part of the body, because these things can stop your heart beating.
Yes, but I think that what I'm getting at is this: once the red dot is on the body or anywhere on the body, I think you know full well what's going to come next should that occur.
What sort of training do police get in the use of tasers, and how widespread is their deployment? I mean, does every single police officer, while they're on duty, have one of these?
No, they don't. I mean, it's quite selective, and what's been happening, because we're currently going through a process now of reissuing tasers, and what I mean by that is making sure the coverage is slightly different to what it has been. The majority of tasers have actually been issued either to policing units, the firearms officers that patrol the motorways, or to the more southern areas in Somerset where you have less police officers. I am aware that we're currently looking at redeployment, and we're probably looking at maybe 2 officers per team carrying a taser.
But isn't there a real issue here that since we've had a cutback in the numbers of the police, that one of the things that they're thinking is there's a sort of shortcut where we won't send so many police to an incident where there may be violence? What we'll do is we'll send just 1 or 2, but with tasers.
I wouldn't quite put it like that. I think, you know, you've got 2 separate issues here. You've got the falling numbers of police officers, which you clearly know what my view is on that, representing the police officers. But, you know, you look at the other issue you mentioned earlier, the incident in Wales. Unfortunately, we don't know the full details of what happened there, but you had a single crewed officer attending that incident. Now, that is more relevant to me if we're having single crewed officers attending violent domestics.
What's the difference then?
Well,
if only one person turns up.
Well, you imagine you walk into, and I will use the Wales story that we're talking about, as a single crewed police officer, you walk into that sort of situation, you're faced with a potentially very violent person. How are you going to deal with that?
Well, I mean, surely that's what they're now thinking in South Wales, hopefully not here, that, well, it may be a violent incident, but if we send one officer with a taser, everything will be fine.
I would imagine that that's not quite the thoughts that the hierarchy are thinking at the moment. Taser is a tool. It's a tool that we would use, same as any other personal protective equipment. It is there to protect the police officers and the public.
but it doesn't protect them if it ends up killing somebody, and they are potentially lethal. I put it to you again, Kevin, that we've had a tradition in this country where we don't arm our police routinely, and that's what's beginning to happen with these tasers. 50,000 volt can stop someone's heart, can kill somebody, and it's a way of arming the police by the back door. We've seen lots of changes in the attitude of government, particularly at the Home Office and the Association of Chief Police Officers, since the 9/11 attacks, and changes in the whole remit of police, where they're thinking much more about, you know, there's a terrorist around every corner, and that this is really part of that, and it's a way of arming the police by the back door.
I think I would go back to the earlier comment, really, Tony. As I say, it is a tool. It is something to use in keeping law and order. I don't regard it as a lethal weapon. Yes, there has been deaths, but then again, you would say that there have been deaths from many other police contacts. It happens.
I mean, people are going to think twice, aren't they, before they phone the police. If they think they're going to turn up armed with a taser, they will think, well, hang on, we would like this person arrested, but or maybe someone that's causing them violence, domestic violence sort of institute, but they're going to have to maybe think twice about calling the police if they think someone's going to get tased and possibly die as a result.
Again, we're going back to a very small number of people that have died in the use of taser. I would probably suggest that the person that's on the other end of the phone that is dialing for the police because they're involved in, quote, a domestic incident, is probably going to be very grateful whoever turns up on that night.
Okay, well, what about let's look now at the slightly shambolic management of Avon Somerset Police at the very top level, with the chief constable having been suspended now for quite a number of months. What is the situation now with the chief constable, and what are we looking at? Because I think he's undergoing some sort of a disciplinary process for inappropriate approaches to female officers.
Well, clearly what happened was a number of complaints were made to the organisation, or to Sue Mount Stevens, the PCC. These were referred to the IPCC, the Independent Police Complaints Commission. They've investigated those complaints and have spoken to probably around 50 people from the constabulary. A report has come back to the PCC, and she has gone down the route of Nick Gargan should be facing a misconduct hearing for gross misconduct.
And does that mean that he may face the sack?
A gross misconduct, he can lose his job, he can face a sack. One point on that that you've got to look at, Nick Gargan is still a police officer and he should face the same disciplinary processes as any other police officer.
Okay, what about the whole process that he was championing? Because when I first saw news stories about Nick Gargan, once he became a police officer, he seemed to be one of the leading chief constables in the country who was pushing this whole idea of direct entry, that is to say, people from outside the police, that is to say, from big business, for example, being able to apply, maybe from private security firms like G4S, for example, being able to apply to become senior police officers, and even, actually, policemen from abroad. We were even talking about one of the top Los Angeles cops applying to become a chief constable here in Britain. So what's the state of play with direct entry, with particular reference to Avon and Somerset Police? Are we going to see, because I know there were adverts out there a few months ago, are we going to see, and have we already got people in Avon and Somerset Police who are from outside British police forces?
We haven't got anybody from an outside police force that's come into Avon and Somerset through direct entry. Yes, the organisation's gone through a process. They've had a number of people interested in that. They've also had a number of people that have been unsuitable for those roles. Clearly, the government's stance is that they want to look at direct entry, and I have no doubt this will be a continuing thing that we have to look at.
So basically what happened was you advertised for people to come in from outside the police force to take these senior jobs, superintendent and upwards, I believe it is, and yet you didn't get any good enough candidates.
I think there was probably two or three candidates that were considered. There's a number of candidates that weren't considered, and I think you would get that with any job application. I have no doubt, as I say, this is the way that the government want to go with the police service. They're looking at direct entry, and I have no doubt they will continue to do so.
Well, let's now move to the big issue for the evening, and that is child protection, because I constantly hear reading articles here from individuals that there is nowhere near enough resources in the police put in to child protection. What's your thoughts about that, Kevin?
I think it doesn't just cover child protection, and whilst I appreciate and agree that what we're talking about tonight is a very high priority thing that needs to be dealt with, we are also looking at human trafficking, cyber crime, everything like that. When you look at the numbers of police officers in Avon and Somerset, you know we've gone through the independent reviews, the budget cuts and everything else like that, comprehensive spending reviews. We're having to cut numbers of police officers. Do I think there's enough police officers out there? No, I don't. Back 4 or 5 years ago, I would have said there was 3,400 and something police officers. I've already seen the projections for 2016-17, where we're looking at 2,512. So that's nearly 900 police officers that we will have lost.
But there's no real excuse, is there, for losing files? I mean, we've heard back in July this year about the Jeffrey Dickens dossier, which apparently was part of 144 files that the Home Office had. How can they lose that many files?
Well, I think I was listening to your programme earlier whilst I was driving here, and I would say exactly the same. How do you lose those files? I understand the thoughts of the conspiracy theories and everything else like that. It certainly sounds like a cover-up, doesn't it?
Now, let's go now to have a listen to Don Hale. He's a newspaper editor in the Midlands, I think Shropshire, possibly, and an award-winning one as well. He wrote a book called Town Without Pity about corruption that had been going on there in the courts and in the police where he was working. And he describes here, this is an interview which was on LBC, London Broadcasting, earlier this week. He was handed a massive dossier in the late 1970s, early 1980s by Barbara Castle about a paedophile ring where there were many prominent people involved. Barbara Castle being a Labour MP, I think it was a cabinet minister maybe, Martin. Then he started to discuss this with some of his colleagues there. He phoned up the Home Office to try and get a statement from them about it. And then he found out the very next day that the MP Cyril Smith turned up. So I'll let Don Hale take up the story from his interview he did with LBC.
Cyril Smith turned up the very next day on my doorstep at the office, and he was very, very aggressive. And I actually had interviewed him several times before. Within 10 seconds of him arriving, he went from Mr. Nice Guy to Mr. Nasty. Was really threatening and aggressive. You know, he's a big guy anyway, but he was really pointing fingers, banging on the desk and demanding I hand over all these papers to him. Well, there's no way I was going to do that. I was saying, you know, this is start of my inquiries, and I wanted response to that. He refused to give a response, eventually stormed out. So the following day, the special branch arrived with a gang of policemen, and they again demanding access to the files. They wanted to take everything away, making all sorts of threats, and saying, if was I prepared to hand them the files? And I was asking, well, what for what reason? And that, they say, you know, that's for us to know. It is not in the public interest. It's a potential threat to national security. You have to hand these files to us. Are you prepared to do so? If you don't, we'll arrest you on the spot and you could face 2 years in jail. Now, I was in possession here, if you recall, of some very sensitive documents. Some of these have got actually not to be removed from the Home Office or for your eyes only, confidential documents. So I was bang to rights in that respect, whereas, you know, as a journalist, I got very sensitive papers here. So you couldn't object to that. They've got a search warrant anyway. Their officers got all the files. I was asked to say, is this everything that's come forward? And I had to say yes, and they took them all away and disappeared.
That was the voice of Don Hale there on LBC earlier this week. He's a newspaper editor, regional newspaper editor from the Midlands, Shropshire, I think. I'm not absolutely sure which newspaper he was editing. But Kevin Phillips, you're joining us, chairman of the Avon and Somerset Police Federation. How does this sort of thing happen? Because there is evidence there. Somebody has managed to get the evidence from the Home Office. That's possibly some of these files which have disappeared now. And then a newspaper editor is interested in writing a story on them. And then he finds, actually, first of all, someone who's now known to have been a paedophile MP turns up, threatens him. And the very next day, special branch turn up. Maybe you could... The easiest thing you could explain is, who are Special Branch?
Well, Special Branch effectively deal with lots of issues to do with national security. That's exactly what they're there for. Now, clearly, as you heard there with regards to that interview, they were saying the issues with the files were a matter of national security. I think what we've always got to look back at, Tony, is much of this sort of issue, the Hillsboroughs and things like that, are quite historical things. Now, I appreciate they've happened, and I appreciate that the police service has been involved in that somewhere, shape or form. But we've got to look now. Would it happen now? I don't think it would.
What makes you say that? What's changed?
I think there's more checks and balances in place now. I don't think people would follow orders blindly, as what probably happened there. You're looking at senior officers would have probably made those decisions and effectively sent the troops in to deal with it.
You can see the problem here, and that is that if people have been abused in the past and then they hear the way that the police have acted in that particular situation, a journalist trying to do a story, trying to expose it in a way maybe like the Liz McKean was trying to do on Newsnight when she was told, oh no, there's a Jimmy Savile special coming up at Christmas, that they're finding it unable to do so. And then at the end of the day, to have the police turn up and to take away the evidence of abuse, which has now disappeared, you can understand why people are reluctant to talk to the police.
Oh, absolutely. As I say, I think one of the biggest problems the police service have got is always having giving people that reassurance that we are there to talk to, we are there and we are available to be spoken to and try and confide in. I understand your issue. I understand exactly what you're saying, but like I go back to, a lot of this was historical matters.
And how big a difference do you think the Jimmy Savile revelations have made? Because I think for many people they saw this as they took a rather tribal attitude to it before that. Do you think that's changed?
I think absolutely. You know, I think this sort of thing has gone on and probably still does go on. We know it still goes on, but at least more and more of it is being brought out into the open and people are being dealt with for the offences that they should be.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we're hearing there about Special Branch who do liaise with MI5. We've heard last weekend about Peter Hayman, deputy head of MI6, actually being a child abuser. And we can only name those people who are dead now. At some point, some of the people who are living will have to be named. But it is rather concerning, isn't it, when you can see that this is just not just prominent people, but extremely powerful people in the secret state.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we use the word national security, what do we mean by this? I mean, Mike Rowley, who's the Deputy Assistant Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, he said the other week, it was in the Daily Star, that they are thwarting 100 Islamist terrorist plots a week. Frankly, I don't take such a statement seriously. And I think ultimately the police, like the Police Service of Northern Ireland, for example, have to actually recognise that the secret state, MI5, MI6, the head of MI6 is being fingered here as a paedophile, terrorism offences, the secret state in Britain and the secret state in the US has been involved in terrorism. And we need the confidence that the civilian police force are independent, sufficiently independent, to be able to pursue people at the top if they are breaking the rules. And I'm sure Kevin would agree that that should be the case, but obviously there's still a question mark, is it the case that the police are sufficiently independent to be able to take on the really powerful people who are potentially terrorists and paedophiles?
Kevin, what would your advice be for people that either have loved ones, friends, or themselves have been abused?
I would say please come forward, because that is the way we have to deal with it. That is the way we can deal with it. You know, the police service has changed considerably over the years, and I think we are quite willing and most able to take on even historical cases. We will deal with them.
And what would you say to people who, for example, there are more revelations this week at the Hillsborough campaigners were spied on? So when people are doing something which is rocking the boat too much, the police have been spying on them. That's been proven in the past.
I can only go back to exactly what I said earlier. A lot of this is from the past times. We've changed. The police service is more open, it's more transparent, and we are working with the public because that's who employs us.
Well, it's also that's certainly good to hear. We've also heard today, Martin, haven't we, that possibly murder or manslaughter could have been involved in these rings. So there are people possibly alive now who have got a lot of potential bad publicity is going to come to them. We're going to hear in a moment from Tim Tate, who did an investigation in the United States, which was spiked. It was never shown. It was an hour-long, very professionally made documentary, all legally watertight. And that was linked to the abuse there, was linked to the Republican Party.
Well, yes, I mean, I'll come back to the point I was making earlier. I would like to think that the police have changed and that we are in a situation where the independent police, which are accountable through police committees and elected commissioners and whatever, are able to take on elements within the state who actually got who have criminal behaviours. And we're talking now about senior bankers, military people. I mean, Brigadier Gordon Curry used to run the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland. There was a 14-year investigation into his behaviour by Sir John Anderton of the Metropolitan Police. But ultimately, Gordon Kerr was allowed to go free. Last we heard of him, he was running something called the Joint Services Group inside the Green Zone in Iraq, even though the British police had fingered him as a terrorist in Northern Ireland. I think ultimately we've got to get to a situation where the police really are independent of government and able to hold the government to account if they're behaving criminal ways.
This latest operation, which has been announced today, it's that what they've said, certainly on the BBC, they were saying at lunchtime, is it actually included law enforcement people as part of that paedophile ring?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, who will guard the guardians? I mean, if the police are sufficiently independent, that's fine. But of course, there's always a possibility that the police are involved in various criminal activities. They're human beings. They're involved. They're mixed with powerful people. The temptation to go along with criminal activity, especially if it's coming from the top, is always going to be there. Okay. And therefore, there's got to be some kind of trust built up.
Okay, Martin and Kevin Phillips, chairman of Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Thanks very much for joining us. We're going to hear now from Tim Tate. He is actually a documentary maker that lives in the southwest of England, and he tells the story of how his documentary on Republican child sexual abuse was made and then closed down, and how the victims ended up dead or doing decades in jail, while many of the US right-wing politicians just carried on in their political careers.
I'm Tim Tate. I'm a documentary filmmaker, investigative journalist and author of books, and I've been doing this for 30-something years for all British television networks and American networks, Al Jazeera, and books for a variety of publishers.
Can you just give us an idea of some of the films you've made that people might recognise, or books?
I worked with Roger Cook for 8 years, both in BBC Radio and then ITV's Cook Report, so this, people might recognise some of those. I've made films for Al Jazeera International, which I think probably has a footprint of about 250 million. So some people have seen those. It's investigative filmmaking. That's what I do. The last thing I made for Jazeera was an 8-part investigative series on 21st century slavery. So we were literally filming all around the world, investigating slavery. Genuine slaves, people who are forced to work, get no pay and aren't allowed to leave, and there are 27 million of them in the world today.
Well, I've come to you today to talk about, particularly about this film Conspiracy of Silence. Tell us what that film was about and how you came to make it.
The film tells the story of the alleged prostitution of young people, teenagers, firstly from America's favourite charity, Boys Town, which some people will remember from the Hollywood movies with Spencer Tracy. Boys Town is a real place in Nebraska. A freelance journalist with whom I'd worked brought me the story, allegations that children from Boys Town were being prostituted by a senior business and political figure in Nebraska, and further that he had prostituted those children, both from Boys Town and from across Nebraska. He'd taken them to be abused by people all over the states, and particularly in Washington, D.C., at what were described as parties with senior political figures.
So what was Boys Town?
Boys Town is, it's a town. It's an incorporated town in Nebraska. It was originally set up for homeless, impoverished, or endangered children in the 1920s, I think, certainly 20s or early 30s. And it was a caring community. It was set up by the church, by a priest. And its aim was to protect and to nurture and to help children in very difficult circumstances. And it has grown and grown and grown, so that, as I say, it is an incorporated town under American law. I think it has its own stamps now as well. It's a charity, and it has been described, and I believe it is, America's favourite charity. The problem was that in the 80s, this very powerful, influential figure, a man called Lawrence King, wormed his way into Boys Town and allegedly began prostituting children from it.
So what did you discover as part of the documentary? You say connections with Washington, D.C., but was it any specific party, any specific people in the main political parties in the U.S.?
That's going to be a complicated answer. There were two waves of allegations. The first happened in the late 1980s, when young people from Boys Town broke cover and made their allegations. By the time I got to the story, it was 3 or 4 years later, and those complainants had disappeared. I spent an awful long time trying to find them, and they had simply disappeared off the face of the earth. There was a second wave of allegations which had happened about a year previously, but from young people, three young people in particular, from Nebraska, not from Boys Town, but who had been involved with the prostitution of children from Boys Town as well as from the streets in Nebraska. And what they described were child sex parties throughout Nebraska, but primarily in Omaha, and they also described being flown to Washington, D.C. to be abused at parties on what is known as Embassy Row, in houses along Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. So we're talking, and they were able to identify these houses to us, very, very wealthy, a very wealthy bit of real estate. They described politicians being present. In one case, there was an allegation of one of the most senior and famous American politicians of the time being present while a young boy was sexually abused. These three young people made their allegations. They made them first to the police and also to a commission of inquiry from the Nebraska State Senate, state government. What happened to those allegations and what happened to those young people was simply disgraceful.
So, what was the motive behind it then?
Behind the sexual abuse? What's the motive behind any sexual abuse?
Well, we're talking about this at the very highest political levels, though. So, you know, this does start to look like more like there is some kind of political motive, possibly.
I think you have to be a bit careful with that. What they were primarily describing was the sexual abuse of teenagers within rich and powerful circles in Nebraska. That happened to involve Nebraskan politicians, but local politicians, them being flown to Washington to take part in child sex or teenage sex parties in Washington, D.C. What was the motive? The presumed motive, or rather what they presumed one of the motives was for them being at those parties in Washington, D.C., was that it gave Lawrence King a great deal of leverage. This was almost exclusively within the Republican Party. Lawrence King was a rising star. He was the rising black star in the Republican Party at the time, and in fact sang the national anthem at the Republican National Convention, which is a huge honour for any aspiring politician.
Are there any senior politicians that were named as part of this investigation?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to name them because we didn't name the most senior ones in the film, because to do so we would have required a great deal more than the evidence we had. But the victims of this abuse, and there's a little question but that they were abused, gave evidence in secret to a grand jury, grand jury testimony is secret. And indeed, they also gave it in secret to a state Senate inquiry. I happened to get access to all of those files and read the names that they testified to. Without question, that should have led to a full investigation by the FBI. One of the things I found most disturbing, and my colleagues found most disturbing, is that rather than investigate, what the FBI was very plainly doing was trying to close the whole thing down.
You mentioned that some of the witnesses disappeared and the victims disappeared, and you found some other ones. It does sort of imply that there's some threats and attempts to close down the investigation one way or another. Did you notice when you were making the documentary, did you find there was any attempt to intimidate you out of doing it, that sort of thing?
Yeah, without question. We were followed by what we believed and were led to believe was the FBI. Our cars were followed. Now, I think if anyone who knows anything about this knows that if you're being followed professionally, you're not going to know about it. Someone was, I think, quite clearly trying to send us a message that we were not welcome in Nebraska. We were there. I was there for a total of 3 months dealing with this. And it was made very plain that we were under observation. No one ever threatened me, for which I'm very glad. That said, some of the witnesses were absolutely intimidated. Two in particular. From the first wave, there was a young woman, very young woman, early, mid-teens, and by the time I tracked her down, and she was one I did track down 3 or 4 years later. She was mid to late teens. It took an awful long time to find her. When I did find her, I literally turned up at her doorstep one evening. She confirmed who she was. She said, yes, she knew what I was talking about, but she was looking around constant. She was very, very plainly frightened and said, would I come back the next day? By the time I got back the next day, the house was empty. I never found her again. From the second wave, there was a young man called Troy Bonner, and if people see the film, they will see him in it. Troy had made allegations and had corroborated the allegations of the two other main complainants. Troy was a troubled young man. He had a serious drug problem, which had not been helped by his involvement in child sex parties. When I found him, he was terrified. He had originally given his evidence. He had then been threatened, so he said, by the FBI to withdraw that evidence and had recanted. So by the time I found him, he was in a pretty tricky state. And I wasn't about to take his word for it that he had been threatened by the FBI or pressured by the FBI, but I found an audio recording in these files which were locked up and kept secret. I found an audio recording made by the FBI in which the FBI introduced themselves. It's an audio recording of Troy ringing up one of the other complainants and trying to get her to admit that she had made up the story. She was incredulous and saying, what are you talking about? Why are you doing this? And Troy, in this recorded phone call, was just about losing it, saying, I can't tell you, you just got to say this didn't happen. And at one point she says, is there someone there with you? Are the police there with you? No, no, no. Now, at the very front of the recording, the police, the FBI, had introduced themselves. This is a recording made by the FBI with Troy Bonner. He was terrified, and he said he'd been threatened by the FBI that if he didn't recant, he would go to prison. As a very severe drug addict, he was worried by that. I spent weeks with Troy. And I persuaded him in the end that it would be better if he told the truth. And that once he'd told the truth, there was no mileage in anyone doing anything to him. And he did. He agreed. And he recanted his recantation and told the truth about all of it on film. And my promise to him had been that once you've done that, and once the film's broadcast, you'll be safe. The film, as people may know, was never broadcast. Troy disappeared, and a year later he was found dead.
Well, there's echoes there of the recordings made by Liz McKean for Newsnight of the victims of Jimmy Savile. She went back to her boss, I think it's Peter Rippon at Newsnight, the BBC here in Britain, and she was told, well, there's a Jimmy Savile special coming up at Christmas, and I'm afraid we won't be able to broadcast. So, well, how does that affect you as a programme maker when you, after, you know, maybe days, weeks, months even of getting someone to go on camera, you're then told by your bosses and the people that own the transmitters and that kind of thing that, oh, we're never going to show this?
I felt then, and I still feel now, at least partially responsible for Troy's death. You know, Troy's death was, as I understand it, the result of a drug overdose. That in itself is no great surprise. He was, as he made plain, addicted to heroin and crack. He also said that if things went wrong, he would be found dead of a drug overdose and it wouldn't be him. Was it him? Did he accidentally take an overdose? Did he commit suicide, or was it something else? I don't know, but I do know that the reassurance I had given him, and which persuaded him to tell the truth, didn't happen.
So what have you learnt since you made that documentary, and what's happened to some of the victims and some of the perpetrators of abuse in Omaha?
I think it's probably worth rehearsing what happened to the film. The film was... I was then working for Yorkshire Television's documentaries department, and which was the best place in Britain and probably the world to make serious documentaries, to make serious films. Yorkshire Television had done a deal with Discovery, the US and European-based cable company, for a series of to make a series of documentaries on its, which would be broadcast on Discovery. And Discovery had leapt at the proposal for our film, Conspiracy of Silence. I can remember the commissioning editor rubbing her hands and saying, it's got everything. It's got politics, it's got paedophilia, it's got everything we want. And they gave us the money to go and make it. And we spent, as I say, I spent 3 months in Nebraska, on and off, and other places, making this film. Everything was shot on 16mm film, which is a phenomenally expensive way of making documentaries. And we brought all the material back to Britain, to Yorkshire, to cut the film. And we assembled a rough cut of the film, which is the normal way of doing things. And that rough cut, my colleague, who was the director and I was the producer, my colleague took that rough cut over to Washington, D.C. to show it, as you would normally do, to Discovery, who were paying for it. In the meantime, my job was to show it to the lawyers and to work with the lawyers to get it into a shape where it was okay, legally okay, to transmit it. Yorkshire Television, under its contract with Discovery, had legal responsibility for doing that. It was our responsibility to get a legal clean bill of health for the film so it could be broadcast. And we had very good lawyers, media lawyers in London, Goodman Derrick, and a very high-powered firm of media lawyers in New York. They went over it, and I showed them the evidence, and both sets of lawyers gave the film a clean bill of health. It was good to go legally. by the time that had happened, Nick, my colleague, the director, had had his meeting with Discovery, who liked the rough cut, but who then, subsequently, turned round and cancelled the film. And I remember, to this day, him ringing me, Nick, my colleague, ringing me in shell-shocked, saying, I've just come out of a meeting, they say they won't broadcast the film. And I asked what the reason was, and this was what he was told, and I quote, "We seem to have gotten into an investigative area which is inconsistent with Discovery's mission statement." Now, you read into that whatever you want to read into that. But Discovery was adamant. I mean, the film was actually in the listings, television listings magazines. It was scheduled. They simply pulled out. They refused to discuss it any further. Eventually, the film was handed back to Yorkshire Television. The rights to it were handed back to Yorkshire Television, with Discovery paying all the substantial costs of making it to date, and Yorkshire given the right to do whatever it wanted to do with it, to get it broadcast elsewhere if it wanted to, on the condition that no one ever associated Discovery with the film.
Now, that's interesting, because surely it would have made sense for Yorkshire to get it broadcast in Britain.
Yeah, I thought that. We were, as you might imagine, pretty shell-shocked. But I began trying to find alternative networks to broadcast this. And in fact, I had a couple of approaches from distributors who wanted to fund the remaining work, and it didn't, I mean, it needed to be finished, it was a rough cut, and to broadcast it or to blow it up to 35mm for a cinema feature documentary. The man who was then running the documentaries department at Yorkshire Television just didn't want to know.
Well, what's your thoughts about what was behind that then? And I wonder if anybody who was from Discovery or from the networks here in Britain, because, I mean, it did touch on some very key and very powerful politicians, didn't it? I mean, one would like to think that they're not actually above the law and not above having documentaries made about them, these key political figures.
And there are a number of answers to that. The film was exclusively American. It was about a situation, a case, a series of allegations, a scandal in the United States. There was no part of the film which touched on Britain. British networks, would they then, would they now have been interested? My guess is probably not. They tend to be quite parochial, and they're not really interested in films which don't have a British angle. This didn't. This was specifically an American film. And in the rest of the United States, I can't think of a single US network, be it cable, be it mainstream television, which would go near this. They don't want to do investigative journalism.
But why not? I mean, I'm a bit annoyed, because you've done all your work, you've found out that it's illegally okay to show, at least, you know, that's what the lawyers are indicating. So how does it work that, you know, powerful people get programmes like this, as it seems, shut down?
That's a very good question. And if I knew the answer to that, possibly I wouldn't be making films, but I would be a politician. I simply don't know the answer. What I can tell you is that Lawrence King, the central figure in this, the man about whom most of the allegations were made and on whom they centred, went to prison for 15 years for fraud. He was unquestionably a fraudster, amongst other things. But if you contrast that with what happened to one of the victims, a young woman called Alicia Owens, she'd been in the second wave By the time I arrived, Alicia had been hung out to dry by the courts in Nebraska. She had been required in court testimony to name her abusers. She had done so. And she was thereafter prosecuted for perjury. And she was given a sentence of between 9 and 27 years in prison for naming her abuser. Firstly, that's a tell to me. That's an enormous sentence for perjury. But what was even more worrying was she was tried in Nebraska state court in Nebraska, and under Nebraska state law, and Nebraska law specifically provided not just protection for naming your alleged abuser, but actually made it a legal requirement. So Alicia was jailed for this huge sentence under a law which didn't exist.
I mean, we've had recently the Jimmy Savile scandal, which actually in some ways many people think may never have seen the light of day if it hadn't been for some dogged attempts to get that story out. And I just wonder if you think the child sexual abuse inquiry that's currently going on, at least there's an attempt to get this child sexual abuse inquiry done by the Home Office, whether you think that we're ever going to get to the bottom of that when we don't have this backstop of the investigative documentaries. Can we really rely on statutory bodies like the Home Office, the courts, to get to the bottom of what really went on?
No, is the simple answer. I, for my sins or otherwise, I have spent 25 years making films and writing books about what adults do to children, primarily child sexual abuse, and the loose, disorganised networks of paedophiles. And there are men who have been to prison because of the work that I was funded to do. But I've worked with a number of police units and departments over the years. All of them have told and continue to tell exactly the same story. We are not given enough resources to do this job. We don't have the manpower. We don't have the trained officers. And the decision not to give them that is a political decision with a small p. Someone has said this is not sufficiently a priority. You know, two small examples. I made a film and wrote a book with a man called Ray Wire, who was then the best expert at dealing with men who abuse children. And it was about what was then Britain's worst child sex serial killer, who's serving a succession of life sentences now. He should have been picked up long before he was. No one had bothered communicating to anybody else his records. But most worryingly, when I went to what was then called the National Criminal Intelligence Service, which has now been superseded by the National Crime Agency, Britain's FBI, effectively, 2 years after he was sentenced, his name was not on their database. And there was a reason for that. And the reason for that was that they had been given, assigned, NCIS had been assigned, 1.5 officers to work on child sexual abuse, paedophile intelligence, whilst in the next office there were 11 officers doing exactly the same job for football hooliganism. Somebody has said football hooliganism is a priority, child sexual abuse isn't. All right, that's 15, 20 years ago. Has it changed? No, it hasn't. I wrote a story for one of the Nationals earlier on this year about a man who had been arrested in Lancashire. He had been The National Crime Agency had been tipped off by the Russian Interior Ministry that this man was trading child pornography via a Russian-based peer-to-peer network. It was a fantastic piece of cooperation from the Russian Interior Ministry. The National Crime Agency farmed this investigation out to Lancashire Police, where the man lived. They raided him. They couldn't find the film he had been trading, but they found other material. One of which was, according to the police, according to the prosecution in the subsequent trial, and according to the judge in that trial, the first snuff child pornography film that had ever been seized. It was a teenage girl shown being sexually abused, tied up and suffocated, and then lying dead. Her face and the offender's face were quite visible on this film. That film was seized a year, 16 months before I got involved in the case. It should have been sent by Lancashire Police to the National Crime Agency, who should have checked with their facial recognition software. They are under an international treaty, binding international treaty, to send that material to law enforcement worldwide, particularly to the United States, which has the best facial recognition software, and particularly because the girl, the victim, and the perpetrator in this were American. They had American accents. 16 months after that tape was seized, it was still sitting in Lancashire Police. No one had done anything with it. We don't assign a priority to this. It doesn't matter, apparently. I think it matters. And I do not understand why we don't do this properly.
Well, don't you think there's a sort of psychology around this, that because it's something that people recoil from, and they will maybe switch the TV off if they see something like this on the TV? It's actually something which actually aids the perpetrators, that.
Documentaries about child sexual abuse, and indeed books about them, are some of the hardest things ever to get commissioned. And it is true that a significant number of people will refuse to watch. I think that's asking the wrong question. I don't really mind if 100 people watch this or 1 million people watch this. Our job is to do the work and to show it, and somehow to get as many people as will watch it to watch it. But more than that, doing what we do is the essential watchdog on the police, on the government, on the courts. If we don't, as journalists, be the dog that barks, who the hell will?
That was Tim Tate there. I was talking to him earlier this week. He's an investigative journalist and producer of Conspiracy of Silence, the film about child abuse in the Republican Party, which was pulled by the Discovery Channel and never shown either on British TV. And more from him next week. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour. That was Gus Hoyt, Green Party councillor, and Martin Fodor. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us on our Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a man described as one of the most prolific killers of the modern age has been found guilty of a double murder in 1977. Angus Sinclair raped and murdered two 17-year-old girls after they'd been to a pub in Edinburgh. The 69-year-old's become the first person to be convicted under Scotland's double jeopardy law. Kevin Scott's sister was one victim.
We have waited 37 years for justice.